as gas prices rise across the world. In the UK, we have seen panic buying, whilst China is experiencing blackouts. In the modern world, we all rely on energy, from plastics for packaging to fuel in your car. Oil has been a strategic commodity for a century and gave us its own balance of power, geopolitics and many wars. Joining me today to discuss everything energy is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are you doing, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, first question, Adnan, could you explain to us how critical energy is in the modern world?
Okay, so energy, whether you realize or not, plays a huge role in the mundane to the most complex things we do on a day-to-day basis. So as you mentioned, from the plastics that we find in our packaging, your television, your mobile phone, it involves some fuel and some form of energy, to the more complex, your electricity, to petrochemicals, to agriculture, which is essential for life. Energy plays a very critical role, and I think many people don't actually realize the role it plays. I mean, you see your car, you need to fuel it, so that you will notice on a day-to-day basis. But many products, many things we take for granted, a lot of them involve some form of fuel, whether it's gas, whether it's oil in their process. So, you know, we literally are in a energy world. That's why there's always a discussion of will we ever get to a post-energy scenario. And the amount of energy we're using is only increasing as well. So energy is absolutely critical for, you know, the most basic day-to-day tasks that we do.
Now, what are the world's most important energy sources at the moment, Adnan?
Okay, so there's a few sources of energy that we use regular. So you have coal, which, when I last checked, still half of the global electricity that we produce, it comes from coal and coal-powered power stations. So obviously coal is one of the oldest fuels that we're still using today. It's also the most dirtiest as well. It contributes a lot towards global pollution, to smog in many, many towns in China. And it's quite a toxic, dirty process. So many countries have moved away from that. And that's where we've seen the emergence of other fuels such as gas and oil. So natural gas, which is found abundantly in different parts of the world, it's used primarily for industry and to heat our homes. The biggest obviously challenge with gas is it's very voluminous. To shift a certain amount of gas, it takes up a lot of storage space and it's very costly as well. Then we have oil, which is probably the most strategic commodity, the most traded commodity on the international markets. So oil is primarily used for transport in the world. If you look at the world's buses, cars, the aeroplanes that we have, they all run on a different form or types of oil. So these are the three main sources we have. You also then have nuclear energy, which where uranium is used in nuclear power plants. And again, uranium is primarily used for electricity. We don't have any other use for it unless you're really keen on developing a nuclear bomb. And then you have what we call renewable energy, your natural sources. So you've got your solar power that uses the sun and converts it into energy. You've got wind power where you use wind turbines. You have dams where you use the flow of a river or ocean or plane of water. So these are the main sources of energy we use. So the challenge here really is how much does each country have of each source in their country? Do they now have the technology where they can convert this fuel, refine it into usable fashion? Then you're probably going to need some sort of distribution system to get the fuel from the original plants to the people, whether it's via petrol stations, via pipelines, via ports. So there's a huge infrastructure that goes around these fuels as well. And all of this, when you combine it, this becomes the energy industry. And naturally, some countries are energy producers. They have a lot of energy. Some are energy consumers. They have very little. So they need to buy it. And that's why naturally there's been wars over these energy sources throughout history because of the strategic role they now play in our day-to-day lives.
Now, of all the energy sources you mentioned, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, oil seems to be the one that's always on the news. It seems to be one of the more important energy sources out of the ones that you've mentioned. Could you tell us a bit more about oil? What at what are its origins? How did it come to take the place, a central place in the world?
Okay, yeah, so oil has about just over 100-year history now. It really emerged as a strategic commodity in the early 1900s. And really, by World War II, the fact that Hitler was trying to get the oil resources off the Caucasus, it really propelled oil as a strategic commodity. What makes oil unique is I once read that, you know, 1 teaspoon of oil gives you the equivalent energy of about 10 horses pushing a cart. So the amount of oil and the amount of output they can give you is actually very, very unique. And that's why most of the world's transport, the engines, are designed to use oil as a source. So really, at the end of the 1800s, three sources or three places really emerged that had significant oil resources. Prior to oil, coal really was the main energy that the world used, and everyone from all the major powers, whether it's Russia, Britain, America, they were looking for a fuel source as an alternative to coal that would be more efficient and give you more bang for your buck, give you more output. Because coal obviously took up a lot of space, you needed coal resources, a very dirty process. So in America, in Pennsylvania, the early days, the late 1800s, there was talks of grass fields bubbling up with black liquid. And that eventually turned into America's oil resources, and the whole industry developed around that. Standard Oil emerged. The Rockefellers emerged as the leaders in developing America's oil market. Then you had the Caucasus. I think at one point, 90% of the world's oil came from Baku in Azerbaijan. And Russia and then the Soviet Union, they were very interested in this. So they developed the industry around that with financing from Europe. And then the oil in Persia emerged. And that was something the Brits always had their eyes on it. In fact, it was the company that became British Petroleum that developed the oil fields of Persia. And eventually the monarchy in Persia gave the British company concession. So these were the three areas that really started the oil industry. But because, you know, the number of people in the world has grown, the number of cars, vans, coaches, trains, airplanes we have grown. So naturally, you know, for transport, the most efficient energy source is oil. And that's why oil is a very, very important strategic source. How do you transport people? How do you transport your troops during war? Oil is absolutely central for that. And that's why over time, oil has come to play a very central role in global geopolitics.
Now, with oil having such a central role in the world, there must be a lot of major players on the world scene. Could you give us a bit more information about these major energy players?
Yes, so you can probably break them down into two groups, from energy producers to energy consumers. So on the energy producer side, you've always had Russia as a major energy producer, major oil producer, and even a gas producer. And that's why Russia's really been in power for at least the last 100 years or so. Then you've got the Middle East. The Middle East emerged, even today, 60% of the world's oil is in the Middle East. So Iran, you've got Iraq, you obviously had Saudi Arabia, and then you've even got Kuwait and the Gulf states as well. So for long, the Middle East has had a lot of oil wealth, and it's not surprising the region's been fought over for such a long period of time. Then you've got the energy in the Americas. So America historically had lots of energy. Canada is also a major oil producer as well, although a lot of its oil is mixed with sand and things like that, impurities. It's quite expensive there to mine it and refine it. Venezuela actually is still considered to have the largest oil reserves in the world today, even though the country is going through a lot of turmoil at the moment. Then on the other side, the flip side, you've got the energy consumer side. So these are countries that need a lot of energy because of the size of their population or their growth, but they lack their own energy sources. So they are important countries from the perspective of they are important customers for the energy producers. So obviously you have China. It's probably one of the largest energy consumers at the moment. You've got Japan, and then you've also got Germany in Europe as well. Germany, I think when it comes to oil, gas, 99% of this is imported from abroad. It has none of its own energy sources. And this was a challenge the Germans faced twice in the two world wars. that if the wars went on for too long, they've got no energy. And that's why I say it was important for Germany to conquer territories that had significant energy sources. So yeah, these are the major energy players, whether they're on the producer side or the consumer side.
So you mentioned some countries who are highly dependent on oil, such as China and Germany. How would these countries actually navigate the energy scene? Would they actually consider oil from certain countries and not from others in order to keep their independence?
So this plays out in different ways, depending on the country's circumstances and its ability to navigate the political field out there. So we take the case of Germany. Germany is in Northern Europe. It's not too far away from Russia that has significant oil resources. And that's why naturally it's now got the Nord Stream 2, which is a pipeline that goes underneath the sea between Russia and China, Russia and Germany in the north. And America's not happy with this because they feel the more Europeans consume Russian energy, it strengthens Russia's situation and it strengthens them against Europe. And the last thing America wants is a Europe that's beholden to Russia. And Russia hasn't hidden historically. It uses energy sales as a way to gain influence over countries. So the Germans have got no choice. From a logistical perspective, it's close. You know, there's no point in them importing energy from the Middle East. It's just going to take ages to get there. There's no pipeline that comes from the Middle East directly. They'll have to come on oil tankers. They'll have to go around the Mediterranean, around Africa. So from a cost perspective, Russia is practically the best option. And historically, the Soviet Union built its infrastructure to take Russian energy into Europe. Japan, China, historically, have got a lot of their energy from the Middle East because it's closer to them. So, you know, the way these countries have to deal with it is they got to play the political field. So what they need to do is try and have a purely economic relationship with these countries to make sure they don't get influence over them. But then navigate on the international arena and ensure that the dependency they have on Russia or the Middle East doesn't get used against them. Now, the Middle East countries, they don't usually use the energy sources as a political tool. You've never seen Saudi, Qatar or UAE or Iraq or Iran use the energy as a political tool. But you find Russia has. You find America has as well, although America uses the dollar. And because oil is priced in the dollar, it puts America in a very unique position. So these countries, they obviously have a long-term strategy. Now, renewable energy is one way they're trying to reduce their dependence on fossil fuel energy sources. So that would have political implications. Now, if most of the EU moved towards renewable energy, then your dependency on Russian energy reduces and Russia's ability to influence you also changes as well. So, you know, different countries navigate this dependency in different ways. Some countries try to use technology, try to find alternative sources of energy to try and reduce their dependency on fossil fuels. The problem you have is whether it's electricity reactors, whether it's transport, whether it's industry, these have for the last 100 years primarily been built upon coal, oil and gas. You can't just easily weed your way off them. You're going to have to completely change your industry in your country, which is not something that happens overnight.
Some of the larger energy companies in the world people have heard about, such as BP, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell. These are some of the largest energy companies in the world, but they're all Western oil companies. How did they come to dominate the market?
They dominate the market today because their countries and their leaders and their politicians, they recognize very early the strategic importance of energy and especially oil. As a result, some of these countries, the governments themselves, through their state-owned companies, they led the drive to develop the technology and find a large source of energy and effectively colonize it and then use that for as long as they could. In other cases, what you found was, for example, in America, the government helped private companies to come and dominate these markets. So the Rockefeller Foundation, you know, became one of the richest people in America because they led the discovery of oil and the development of oil in America. You find in Russia, generally, it's been state-owned. Although you've got Gazprom today, which is an independent company, so the state gives it significant support to keep it there. In the Middle East, what you find is you have state-owned companies or sovereign wealth funds which are owned by the governments. But there's no direction here in terms of future technology development. If you look at the Middle East, everything they do to get energy out the ground is taken from the West. The technology, the infrastructure was built by the West. There's nothing in the Middle East where it's indigenous in terms of the industry. It's been completely built by them. So because the West saw very early the strategic importance of oil, they made sure that they put the infrastructure in place. They made sure they got their companies to lead in this way. So a lot of these oil companies, you know, they get a lot of political cover from their country. So America invaded Iraq. Originally, many oil companies in America were very keen to develop Iraq's oil fields. This is a country that's in the top 10 when it comes to energy reserves. Obviously, in the end, a lot of American companies felt that they were unsure about the profitability of Iraq's oil. They were unsure of the level of security in Iraq for them to actually make a profit. And obviously, investing in Iraq would have been a long-term investment. So eventually, what you've seen in Iraq is many of the contracts have gone to non-American or non-Western companies. They've gone to companies from the Far East. They've gone from companies from other countries. But putting that aside, that the West very early identified and recognized the importance of oil. So for them, supporting their companies to come and dominate this area, this became a strategic priority. And you're seeing the results of that now, where the top energy companies are all Western companies.
Now, I get that point about the Western world actually coming onto the energy scene very early. But we have a lot of these Middle Eastern nations. Yeah, they came onto the scene late. But considering over 60% of the global oil is found in this region, how come we haven't seen any of these nations progress and become global powers?
So it fundamentally comes down to the rulers in these countries. These monarchies, they have absolutely no ambition beyond their territories. They've got no ambition to be regional powers. They've got no ambition to shape the world in a way that suits their interests. You look at Saudi Arabia, what's their interest? Well, beyond Iran, there is no interest really. And Iran's a country in its own region. You look at the US, you look at Britain, you look at Germany, you look at France. Some of these countries don't even have a lot of energy resources, but they've got ambitions for the world. They've got interests in the world which they want to secure, and they're prepared to maneuver politically and use the military when needed. This is not the type of rulers that you have in the Middle East. The rulers in the Middle East are just happy to have wealth. And I think the important thing here is, you know, if you look at the history of the Middle East, what you really had was multiple tribes fighting each other. So some of these tribes, with the help of Britain and France, they were able to take power over territory and turn it into a country, which the West recognized. Saudi Arabia is an example of that. All the Gulf countries are examples of that. These are not countries that have always existed. They were literally created out of thin air by Britain mainly. So the Saud family, who were fighting all the other factions all the time for power and resources, they, with the help of Britain, were able to come to power, and they happened to have had the largest oil field in the world in their country, the Ghawar oil field. But they're just happy to get the wealth. They're happy to dominate Saudi Arabia. They use that wealth to suppress their people, suppress the other tribe that they've always been fighting. They don't look beyond that. They don't look beyond that at all. And that's why, yes, Saudi has the largest oil field in the world. Qatar and Iran share the largest gas field in the world. Pakistan is considered to have the largest untapped coal reserves in the world. But none of these countries have used the resources and developed into regional powers, let alone, you know, powers that operate at a global scale. And that's why, you know, in some ways, the resources that have been found have benefited the royal families or benefited a few individuals, but it's not benefited the nation as a whole or improved their position in the world.
Now, talking about regional powers, China and India are becoming very strong, especially China in more recent years. But neither of these were actually oil exporters or energy exporters. How do they actually fit in this energy context?
So where China and India come into the equation, or some people call it China-India, is these two countries are really going to drive a lot of the energy consumption going forward. So if you're an energy producer, you're going to want to have good commercial relations with India and China. But as their populations grow and as these countries develop, they will be consuming more and more of the energy of the world. So in the case of China, you find now China is Saudi Arabia's largest customer. It's not America anymore. You look at India, most of India's energy is coming from the Gulf states. And going forward, even more is going to come from there. So if you're an energy producer, when you're looking at where we're going to make money from, you're looking at these two countries, you know, huge countries, 1 billion plus populations. They're growing at breakneck speed. They're going to be consuming the energy of the future. This obviously poses some challenges for these two countries because in a way they're developing, they're becoming important, but you're always going to be dependent upon someone else for energy. So their hope is the countries that they have energy relations with, they have good commercial relations, you know, they're paying for the energy. Those countries are making money and they leave it at that. None, you know, in this equation, they don't want the other country to use it for political gains. So if Saudi Arabia were to reduce production of oil, forget China and India, will affect the whole world because that's a significant amount of oil no longer being produced. So these two countries, they come into the equation because they are going to be very soon the two largest consumers of energy. So, you know, if you've got a product to sell and these are the main customers they're buying, you're going to want to make sure you build the infrastructure and you have good relations with these two countries because there's money to be made.
Now, we spoke about earlier, we touched on the topic of renewable energy and how some consumer countries are trying to develop in this field. And it's actually getting quite big now. Would you say that with the renewable energy market growing, would you say fossil fuels will be redundant in the not too distant future?
So, yeah, there's been an endless debate about this. Are we seeing the end of fossil fuels? When will fossil fuels end? And especially with the level of pollution in the world, there's been a lot of talk about this. So renewables have come a long way. They are a lot more cheaper now compared to just 10 years ago. The challenge you've really got at the moment is renewables are not in a position for the moment to replace fossil fuels purely from the perspective of how much energy you get out of these sources. Whether it's your dams, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, they don't produce sufficient energy to completely replace fossil fuels. What you get out of fossil fuel energy is just very unique. You don't get that amount of energy. So in many ways, renewable energy will play a supplementary role rather than completely replace fossil fuels. So for example, if you could use renewable energy to fulfill the growth that every year occurs in energy use, and that would be a very useful role for renewable energy. For renewable energy to completely replace fossil fuels is very, very far off. Also, I mean, just to take, you need lots of solar panel to produce solar power. You can't put solar energy everywhere. And when the sun goes down, you're not producing energy anymore. Same with wind power. If there's no wind, you don't have any energy. So these are very intermittent, and that's their biggest shortfall. With coal, you keep putting coal into a power plant, it will keep producing electricity. Oil goes much further compared to any other energy. So yes, there's a lot of hope with renewable energy. There's a lot of noise out there about renewable energy. But we've got to be honest, you know, the nature of renewable tech is it will supplement rather than replace fossil fuel use.
Now, you can't talk about energy and oil without talking about climate change. And climate change is really big. It's on the center stage at the moment. We've got the COP22 coming up in UK at the end of the month. Could you outline the climate debate for us and give us some insight into that?
Okay, so in a nutshell, the climate change debate is our climate, the ecosystem we have, you know, the weather, the water patterns, precipitation, this is changing. And the reason why it's changing is all human induced. It's because of the amount of energy we're utilizing, which has a knock-on effect. A lot of the energy goes out in terms of pollution and its use is heating up the earth. So because temperatures are rising, that's having a knock-on effect on all the systems in the environment that we have. So you've got different spectrums on this now. So on the left, we're getting to a tipping point where there'll be the point of no return. So their position is we need to completely reduce and then eradicate fossil fuel use, because I think 80% of the emissions we have in the world come from fossil fuel. So that's their position, and they're very loud about it. Then you've got the position on the right, and there's two positions on the right. One is that this is all a conspiracy. The Earth has been warmer historically. In fact, the Earth getting warmer is based upon data that's only been collected from about 1850 onwards. So it's not from prior to that. So their view is it's all a hype and it's all conspiracy and we don't need to believe it. Then the other view, which is considered on the right as well, is that yes, we recognize that there's a problem with climate change. But the best solution is we shouldn't let this affect our economy. We still need to keep the economies growing. So their view is we need to invest in technology which is energy efficient. And that's the solution to this. So what they're saying is let's wait another 50 years. Let us develop the tech and then there's no problem. We can keep producing. We can keep consuming. We can keep emitting. But because our technology is efficient, it won't have that much of an impact on the environment. So they're saying give us another 50 years and we'll get there. The conspiratorial law on the right are saying we don't need to do anything. We can keep living the way we are. It's all a conspiracy. And on the left, you know, doomsday is upon us. Unless we change the way we live, unless we do something about fossil fuel use, we're getting to a tipping point where, forget the Earth, we're going to have to find another place to live out there in the universe. So obviously it's become a very topical debate. Many politicians from different sides of the spectrum, they take a position. They've taken it to be their political objective, the issue of the environment. I mean, as a final point, what I will say is there are so many claims about the climate and, you know, people are coming from political positions. You know, some, you know, there's a lot of money flowing into some of these positions. Energy companies don't want fossil fuel use to reduce. It completely impacts their work. And in some ways, the ideological position on this, we've come to a standstill. So what we really probably are going to need is an alternative civilization with an alternative view on the world. It needs to actually measure the claims of climate change. You can't expect anyone to do it here because, you know, it's become, with capitalism, they've come to a complete endpoint where they've got differences amongst themselves and they can't move forward. So you need a different civilization that actually looks at and assesses the claims of climate change. None of this takes us away from the amount of waste being put out, from the what's happening with the oceans, from consumerism leading to all sorts of waste, from the growth imperative. The fact that the economy needs to grow is leading to more and more toxicity, leading to pollution going out there. None of this takes us away from that. In fact, even before the climate changing, these are already issues that we have, and these are more immediate. You know, the number of cities where it's not safe for you to be there, even brief. Lahore and I think Dhaka are the worst cities when it comes to pollution. Many of China's cities have smog all year round. I mean, during the Olympics, they had to use seeding in the atmosphere to get rid of the smog. These are immediate issues even before you look at the climate. But the whole climate debate is within the context of the economy still needs to grow. And that's a capitalist principle, you know, the growth imperative. The economy has to grow. So that's why the right view about tech, what that means, let's keep the economy growing. We just got to find the right tech. So as you can see, just from this short summary, there's a lot of perspective to the climate debate.
Now, you mentioned that the argument that all these sides are proposing, they all still agree on the fundamental basis that the economy still needs to grow. Wouldn't you say that it has to grow? Are you proposing that we let the economy shrink? Wouldn't that actually create more of a problem for societies?
Yeah, so, you know, not having economic growth is considered blasphemy in liberal capitalism. I remember even studying economics at university. The problem is, should the purpose of life be more of everything? You know, there's a ideological discussion to be had here. Is life all about consuming more? Because there's ramifications. But you consume more, more has to be produced, more energy has to be used, there has to be more waste. You can't just leave that to another day. Now it's coming to haunt you in terms of the pollution, in terms of toxicity that you have, in terms of the water being contaminated. This is the result of consumerism. This is the result of capitalism. We're in this position that the world is getting warmer, not because there was some other ideology of producing. You know, a lot of this from the Industrial Revolution era. So there's a debate to be had here that should the purpose of an economy purely be economic growth? Because if the assumption here is if the economy grows, more people are consuming more, and more of people's needs are being met. That's the assumption here. And that's an ideological position that comes from liberal economics. There are other views to this. There are other views of what's the purpose of humans? What are the actual needs? There are differences on this. But because capitalism has been the dominant ideology for the last 100 years, or even the last 50 years, or even the last 25 years without communism, it's dominated the international system. And it's during this period we've seen that climate and pollution has got worse. So there's a debate to be had there. You know, should the growth imperative be the purpose of an economy?
Now, with all these ideas in mind and all these trends, where do you think energy will be in the future?
So we have 7 billion population in the world, and it's estimated that by the end of the century, we would have reached about 11 billion. So population is only growing. That means more resources are going to be needed. But we're in a situation at the moment where, you know, Industrial Revolution finished 1850. Since that time onwards, all the easily accessible energy has already been used. So going forward with the increasing population, we're going to have to find new resources. And these new resources are going to come from more riskier places. So if you take oil, for example, most oil, it comes from onshore areas or just offshore. Now you're going to have to go further and further into the oceans to get energy. And that there's all sorts of issues there about safety and things like that. Russia has lots of energy in Siberia, but it's too cold there. But Russia has used a lot of its easily accessible energy. So if it wants more energy, it's going to have to go to these more riskier places. And if you look at oil, even today, 50% of our oil actually comes from around 115 large oil fields. And the estimate is, by most analysts, you're not going to find another Middle East again. Even the Arctic, which is going to come online, you're looking at about 50 billion barrels of oil. You know, that's about a decade or so. If you look at gas, I think three countries, Qatar, Iran and Russia, they control about half of the market. But again, a lot of the easily accessible gas has been discovered. What they're now discovering now is gas further out in the ocean, in areas which are hard to reside. So Russia, for example, is looking to start developing its Arctic gas field, but it has no population there. To get energy out of the ground, you need infrastructure, you need skilled labor. Same with uranium. If you look at cobalt, if you look at all the metals that we have, we've been getting them out of the ground at a very rapid rate. And obviously the easiest to get out the ground, profit perspective, a lot of these have already been utilized. So we need more energy because there's going to be more people in the world. And that means this energy, we're going to have to go to those more difficult and isolated places where profit will be a major, major issue in these sort of places.
I guess with that sort of trend in terms of growth in population, we really need to think about the way we're going in terms of production and consumerism, because we probably can't sustain that.
Yeah, that's really the direction the discussion needs to go. But what you're finding is most of the discussion, I mean, now the discussion is going to space tourism, going to other orbital planets, going to out of the Earth to try and get resources as well. In fact, what's driving a lot of this, the future of space, actually is we've used a lot of the resources on Earth. We've destroyed the ecosystem. We need to now go beyond and go somewhere else. So what that shows you is keeping the economy growing, keeping consumerism going, that isn't changing. That's not changing at all. And you're right, as you said, that's where the discussion really needs to be. I mean, even the key solution they've got for reducing emissions is to have these emission targets. And these emission targets can be traded between countries, which completely defeats the purpose. You've got an emission target to reduce the amount of emissions you have, but you're trading it with another country. Completely defeats the perspective. But again, if you reduce the amount of emissions, then that will be good for the environment. But reducing emissions means your industries need to produce less, which affects economic growth. So this comes back to, again, the growth imperative at the moment is driving the whole debate. And no one's really presented an alternative. I mean, you've got the Greens who believe, you know, if we can move towards green tech and green energy, yeah. But as we discussed, green energy, the amount of energy we are consuming, green energy cannot produce that amount of energy at the moment. Even nuclear energy, which people don't consider renewable, but it's not a fossil fuel as well, it's lost a lot of its popularity because of the Fukushima disaster, Chernobyl. Although nuclear produces a lot of energy, you know, these plants, they last for 25 years, the nuclear plants, the waste from there has to be stored somewhere. So even when a plant ends, it hasn't actually ended. For the next 100 years or so, the fuel that you used and the waste, it has to be stored somewhere because it's toxic as well. So there's issues even with that as well. So as you can see, I'm sure a lot of this will be discussed at the COP summit. But it shows you that you know, energy is such an important aspect of our daily lives. The direction this goes on, the direction all this goes will have an impact on our lives.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issue raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you'll find comprehensive insights. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.